big time story.
Cool. Did they let you take pictures, Richard?
I had a big time
story. Did you bring your stuff?
Great.
Okay.
What else besides
Berlin, the rededication of Berlin Synagogue. Synagogue in Berlin. I saw somebody send it to me, a link to some pictures. Just
beautiful. I was in Munich before they rebuilt entirely. I have to say, Yimach Shemo, the seat of Nazi power, was there, right?
Yep.
Sorry.
They had that wonderful.
And to have the synagogue reborn is one thing. That it was majority German Jews and Russian Jews made it unbelievable, because the Soviet Jews had gotten out of the Soviet Union, and the German Jews were coming back. And then they had several Jewish people who were converts, because in Germany there's a list of thousands who would like to convert to Judaism. And my friend Rabbi Marcus Haupt in Munich helped people who wanted to reclaim Jewish roots, because sometimes people were converted out back in the 19th century in Germany already, and then they figure out that they're really part of the Jewish people. And there are those who are anew looking to become Jews because they feel like this is a fix, which is then a motivation questioned by the rabbinate in Germany. Very interesting story in modern Germany. Anyway, we are holding in Perek Shishasar, 16th chapter of Shabbat. And I want to start on 116a3, and then we're going to try to move to the second side of the daf, and maybe push down at least all the way through the next Mishnah, if not into the Mishnah and the Gemara. So that would be a nice pathway for us in terms of starting and finishing tonight. I have to say also that I had my first opportunity to start my learning for this week in a downloaded Art Scrolls Schottenstein edition. So there, I now have the set of Schottenstein Talmud here on my iPad. And what's fantastic about it, just so that, is that when you move the top, I don't know if you can see this from where you are, when you move the top, the notes kind of go right along with it. So if you're in a section, the notes go with it. So I know we're going to start, for instance, after all the blank portions of a scroll and whether you could save them from a fire, right? The big question we're still working with is, can you save holy scrolls of Torah writings and prophets' writings and the writings part of the Tanakh? The Tanakh, can you save it from a house where the fire breaks out on Shabbat? We don't want to put out the fire, nor do we want to carry it into the public domain. Those are the main issues in regards to carrying something. And yes, the question is, shall I let them burn or not, along with the other property in my house? Do I just let it burn or not? Because I don't want to carry it, and I don't want to put out a fire. We're that serious about developing the Shabbat culture. So we're past all that now. And we're going to look at a section.
Is it searchable?
Of this page. No, this does not have a search engine. Well, it does and it doesn't. It's not the same as like a big database of texts from all volumes. I can search within one volume, but I can't search the entire Talmud. So if I want a saying from all places in Talmud, a technical term of Talmud learning, I really can't search for it per se. I can search within the volume itself, and I might be in volume 4 of a 4-part Masechet Shabbat, Tractate Shabbat, right? So I'm really not doing a full search. They're going to come up with that at some point. They're just going to have the text of the Talmud, and then I can go into the translations within the volumes in terms of the electronics of it all. But, so here, I'm going to start us from here, which is on 116a3, where it says, Yosef Bar Chanin inquired of Rabbi Abahu. Mm-hmm. He asked Rabbi Abahu, So it's probably about 3/4 into any translation that anybody brought a copy of and is following along in that. So then I have the notes here. And what's really neat about the notes is once I go down into the notes, like we're going to have a note about one section that we're going to start with, I can hit on the hyperlink, and it gives me a fuller page of Talmud with all of the commentaries of not only Rashi and Tosafot, and maybe Rabbeinu Hananel, who's on the typical page of the Vilna print, but I get different commentaries on the sides. They're making a fuller page on an electronic version of the Talmud. Fantastic work. Soon they'll have diagrams, soon they'll add all kinds of things. They don't have it yet. So, yeah, it's going to be now across all platforms as well. It started only on iPad, and now they've made it on all platforms. The iPad itself is a different cost.
Yeah, I know that.
The set of Talmud for the iPad runs about $1,000, and then they put it on special for about $800.
Oh, the whole Talmud.
That's the whole Talmud.
Not just this volume.
Right. The books themselves, like if you bought this size, it's about $1,900 for a new set during Hanukkah. And the smaller size is about, I don't know, 1,600. This set is not fully printed yet, by the way. Remember, this is Rabbi Steinsaltz's work that's just been translated. And again, I'm going to open the pages there because he's got stuff that the volumes in the Schottenstein doesn't have. And sometimes, remember, we read him about making a clearer translation. Okay. Okay. 116A3. Yosef Bar Hanin. By Emine Yosef Bar Hanin Mirabi Abahu. So Rabbi Yosef Bar Hanin inquired of Rabbi Abahu. He asked him a question. Hani Sifrei Devei Avidan. These books of Bei Avidan, Matzilin otam mipnei hadoleika, or ein matzilin? May we save them from a fire on the Sabbath, or may we not save them? So, again, the note on my iPad version, I can go right to the Hebrew. I want to read it to you. So, Rabbeinu Hananel is the place where we basically learn what Rashi even says. Or Rabbeinu Hananel has it more in its entirety. So, says the following. What are these books of the Beit Avidan that we're talking about? You asked me before if I could save Torah scrolls. You asked me before if I could save prophet scrolls. You asked me before if I could save the writings. You asked me before if I could save the translations of our Torah. You asked me before if the translations were in one language versus another. But what about these Bei Avidan scrolls that I happen to have, by the way, what? In my house. Because we're talking about the context of being in a private domain, and we're not talking about being in the Bei Avidan, but we're talking about having one of these. So again, I just talk about the sociological tension sometimes. I've got one of these texts. Keep that in mind. Why I'm pointing it out has not become clear yet, but it's interesting that someone would have one of these. Rabbeinu Hananel says the following: Sifrei de Bei Avidan, Chatzer Yadua leMalachim. It's an area that's familiar in royal homes. It doesn't just mean kings. It's an area that's familiar in royal, let's say, districts, almost. In other words, the ruling authorities have a district. And there's such a thing called the Bei Avidan, the House of Avidan. Bei is short for bayit. V'yesh ba sifrei chachamot mikol uma. And in those places we call the Bei Avidan, there are wisdom books from all nations of the earth. every nation that's known to us, in other words. So immediately, just if I said that was what the definition was, and I didn't read further in the in Rabbeinu Hananel, what does it sound like? Like a library. Like some type of layer house, almost. A learning, intellectual Beit Cafe of sorts, a cafe of sorts, where intellects come and different texts of wisdom are present. Okay, the Gam says also, the Yeshba Sifrei Torah, Kadosh. And there are actual Torahs there as well, scrolls of our Chumashim, scrolls of our books of law. Unevi'im u'kituvim. Kituvim b'lashon ha-kodesh. He says, and they are there in the holy script of Hebrew. Umipnei she'eno yadua mi katvan o Yisrael o zulatan. And because, remember, we're talking about scrolls that we don't know if Jewish scribes wrote them and it's according to the Jewish tradition, or it's other scribes according to their traditions. Amru al Rabbi Abahu Shahaya Hadavar Rafe Biyadi Lahorot Alehen Lahatzilan Olo. He therefore could not make the teaching whether or not you actually save those particular books. Because we know that we save that which is canonized, codified, textualized, homogenized in a certain sense, made into, instead of a pluralistic text in its extant nature, in other words, one text is different over here than over there, right? They moved into having one text, a unified text, a single script, manuscript at that time in the Talmud. So he didn't know how to rule.
V'ze avidan hayu mitkabzin sham chachamim univonim mikol uma.
And in this Beit Avidan, let's just say that that's the name of, like, you know, the little awning. It just says Beit Avidan. It's not the Beit Midrash of the rabbis. It's not the study house. It's not the Beit Knesset. It's not the synagogue. It's not Beit HaMikdash. It's not the temple. It's just a different institution at the time. We're getting a picture of what's going on institutionally in that time.
And what would happen? Sages and geniuses from all of the nations would come.
This is like TED Talks. Back in the time of the Talmud, if we could say Ten Talks are really genius.
V'chein Bei Nitzrofi.
And so too, this coming up in our Gemara, the Beit Nitzrofi. It's another name of such a kind of institution that was exactly in the model of Bei Avidan. So we have Bei Avidan, and we have Bei Nitzrofi. Mihu B'nei Nitzrofi Hayitasham Avodah Zarah.
But with Beit Nitzrofi, that we're going to say in a minute about Beit Nitzrofi, we're going to talk a minute about this place. There we knew idol worship was going on.
Meaning what? At Beit Avidan, there's some question. That's right, that's how Gemara works. If I say for sure that one happens to have something, it means quite possibly and maybe for sure that the other one didn't. That's Talmudic logic, right? So at the Beit Avidan, I have all the sages and geniuses, and their books are everywhere, and it's books that have Hebrew books in addition to non-Hebrew books. I'm probably talking about Hebrew and beyond Hebrew. Greek. Who knows if there's Assyrian. But for sure, Aramaic. And so over there, that's what's happening. And with the Beit Nitzrofi that has idol worship, then what I also worry about, as it's going to tell me further in the Gemara, that something kind of bad could happen there. And so in regards to the texts that we might find there and encounter there, in even this intellectual discussion, I have to be a little bit more careful with those. Okay, so leave that, again, on the shelf. So Yosef Bar Hani, back to the Gemara, says about Beit Avidan, about can we save them or can we not save them, Rabbi Abahu says the following. Ein V'lav v'rafaya b'yadeh. Yeah, no. Yeah, maybe no. No, maybe yes. It was kind of wobbling in his hands, says the Gemara. He's, what do you call that when somebody, you know, basically they fumble.
They flip-flop. He's a wet fish. He has no answer. He says, well, yeah, well, maybe no. Boy, they're in Lashon HaKodesh. They're in Hebrew. Seems like we should save them because that's what we just said. But on the other hand, it comes from the Bay of Vida. I don't know what to do with them. So the Gemara continues along. Rav lo azil le Bay Avidan. So let me tell you about what this Bay Avidan. Rav wouldn't go there. V'chol shekein le Bay Nitzrafi. And even the more so, he wouldn't go to the Bay Nitzrafi. Shmuel le Bay Nitzrafi lo azil. Shmuel, however, well, he would not go to Bay Nitzrafi. Levei Avida and Azil. He would go to the Bay Avida. So I love this, right? Who are Rav and Shmuel, first of all? Rav and Shmuel are a pair in Babylonia. They live in Bavel. And they're well known for being bar pluta. They're well known for being in a machloka with each other. And one is in Pumbadita. One is in one of the central places for Babylonian Jewry. And one is in one of the other central cities, Nuria. So, what we see here is the Gemara, and we recognize in our culture, is that in one place, a sage could go one place, and another place, a sage could go a different place. So it's kind of like this, with Bay Avidan. The public library is having a lecture. Maybe one sage over here on the Upper East Side is going to go to that lecture. But maybe over by Brooklyn, no one would ever walk into the public library. But if you ever go to the JTS library, every now and then there's a chassid who's interested in the microfilm that I have up of the manuscript tradition of the Kedushas Levi that we're learning this year. And he says, wow, I didn't realize there were different manuscripts of that book. Are there differences? So whereas one would maybe go to this public place, that's even a Jewish place, but now take the public library. Would that chassid from over there, even though the master doesn't go, would he go into the lecture at the public library? He just might go. Maybe he'd be considered on the outskirts of that community by way of intellectual curiosity. This is part of our peoplehood from this moment. And there were centers of secular learning that we're, in essence, somehow kind of even respecting through the Gemaras, including them, and through the Gemaras' channels of telling us about the culture. Now, certain of this culture we didn't necessarily respect because either there was idol worship going on or there was anti-Semitism happening. And you're going to see a comment that anti-Semitism was rampant even then, right? And certain kinds of animosity towards the Jewish people who accepted what they thought was the Holy Writ were challenged, and the wisdom that they brought to the world was challenged entirely. And their life was put on the line. As a matter of fact, the next section probably goes towards being nervous about that. Excuse me. So, listen to the reason why Rava, about what he would do with the Bet Avida. So, Rava's asked, Amru Leila Rava. They ask Rava, Mai Tama Lo Atit Levei Avida. Why do you not come to debate with us at the Bet Avida? Huh? Why don't you come to debate with us? Already we know, there are those who go to the Bay Avida. But why don't you come? Why are you refusing? Amar Lehu, he says to them, and there are a couple of possibilities as to what this means. I want to ask you on first blush, what do you think it means? He says to them, Dikla palmia ika ba'orcha v'kasheli. There's a certain palm tree on the way and it's difficult for me to go past it. If you didn't have the Art Scroll idiomatic translation or the Steinsaltz idiomatic translation, what would you say his answer is saying? It's not guess what I think. I'm saying there's a palm tree there that I don't go past.
And if there's a bar, or there's a Bordello that he doesn't go past on the way.
Okay.
I mean, it could either be literal or it could be metaphorically. He has a difficult time getting past something in order to go there. It's an obstacle. It could be a psychological obstacle or it could be a real obstacle. Something.
All these are possible. It's just an excuse. There's actually a halachic issue. What was the other one you brought up?
No, I just said he just doesn't want to tell them exactly why.
He just doesn't want to tell them, so it's that nice excuse. It's somehow metaphorical. It's somehow real that it's physical.
I think he is telling them he's being sarcastic.
So it sounds like he's being sarcastic. Interestingly,
there's a palm tree, I don't want to step over.
Yeah, right. Right. There's a palm tree. Well, first of all,
what does a palm tree represent?
First of all, let me tell you what it represents. And let me read you the idiomatic translation of the art scroll. Again, I like to do some of this comparison work. The art scroll says there's a certain palm tree on the way, and it's difficult for me to go past it because its roots make the road uneven. Was he an injured walker who had some difficulty? I'll take it for what it says. And if you've never noticed that some people have a hard time actually mingling within the Kiddush room, and they have an easier time sitting on the outside, you know, it's actually something to empathize with. Some people do have physical problem. I think the Gemara's read here is that you might have a physical problem getting someplace or another. Right. Did you ever, when Soho used to have, I used to come in when I was younger, so when it had all the galleries, and you had the cobblestones, and people liked to walk through, and late at night, when you didn't have as much light as you have now, it was actually pretty treacherous. We were on Fifth Avenue coming down from the outside of the park. I was there with Yona, and we're walking, and as a matter of fact, I'm walking, and I'm saying, like, how do some people walk on Fifth Avenue up here? And it's right across Dovka from Mount Sinai Hospital. I'm thinking to myself, like, who's going to push a wheelchair down Fifth Avenue on this side? Thank God the sidewalk on the other side is very smooth. But it's a little uneven. Thankfully for Jonas, they could caught all the leaves from fall, and he got to actually splash through leaves again. So that's a read. That's one read. I do think it's a serious read. I don't think it's a read that we have to dismiss as being, you know, kind of like he's only making an excuse if we really go to the serious ends of what he might be saying. But if we read the following piece of the Gemara before this little section of Rava's answer ends, it might be that he's kind of making an excuse. He says, if you turn the page to end 116, if you're in the art scroll, Ni'akre, so we'll uproot it for you. Ah, duch de kasheli. And he says, you know, that spot where you uproot it from, it's still going to make it difficult for me to pass. So, you know, okay, you could take it to the reality level that I was getting at, that it's hard ground to walk, it's a lot of roots, there's simply no other passage, I'm not going to get caught there, I really can't do this physically, don't ask me again. Okay, a possibility. On the other hand, most people go different directions in, by way of commentaries. Rashi says on this issue that kasheli, it's difficult for me, recho. And why is it difficult for me? Because it smells there. So it's like going past the place with who knows what, either sewage or garbage or something along those lines. You know, very real in that sense too, you know, potentially. I don't like to go over that place because there's a certain smell. Okay, maybe. V'chol zeh, and all this, Rashi says, though, shayu mit yairin rava milka lebei avidan shema mitoch shi yichai v'chuchu yamtu alehem v'yaharugam. Oh, here's what they're really saying. It's saying that they're talking to Rav and Rava about going there to this Bay Avidan, and that they're going to actually have these arguments, and from amidst the fact that they're going to be in the arguments, right? Yamdu alehem, and they're going to stand over the meaning. They're going to win the argument. And what's going to happen to them? Vayahargum. And the people at the Bay of Edan are going to kill them. So they're actually worried for their lives. And that the culture of losing these intellectual debates in terms of the Chachamim and the Nevonim, the sages and the geniuses of the kingdom, that they shouldn't be embarrassed, and they would actually rise up and kill the colonized people. Not far from the truth of what sometimes would happen with debates. Because if you win, you've lost. And if you lost, you lost. In certain cases. That's where Rashi really brings it. He's scared. That's the Bay of Edan. The Gemara continues. Mar Bar Yosef says, Ana minayhu, Ana lo mistafina minayhu. I am one of them on good terms with the people there, and I don't fear them. So he says, listen, guys, at this point in the saga, it's not that bad. I've gone. I've created a relationship or two. I have interesting intellectual discussions. You can just fill in the blanks. But the Gemara comes. Zimna chada azil ba'u l'sakune. One time, however, he went to debate with them, and they attempted to endanger his life. In my thought questions for the day, Jay, Baruch Shekivanti. I'm writing down little questions in my Gemara as I'm learning today. And I'm saying, so why didn't the rabbis make halakha regarding not going to the Beit Avidah? If they knew it was sakanat nefesh, that it was a challenge to one's life. The fact that it's in the Gemara doesn't say never look into the philosophy, the wisdom, the thinking, the teaching of other umot, of other nations. In fact, the fact that it's in the Gemara is a nice statement that we actually look to that, and we could even think of the dialogue as being typical of culture. Somewhat typical of culture. For a few, outside of the pale. That's always going to be. We have those who are more unwilling to engage in the culture, right? But here, even the guy who had a relationship, you know, he's not willing to go so close. You know, it almost feels like Shalom Aleichem time, you know, in thinking about the relationships between the Cossacks and the Jewish community. These are real throughout Jewish history. We don't have to go there to Shalom Aleichem. This is a reality that's coming through, the historical reality is coming through. Do you have an answer? Because I don't have an immediate answer. I didn't find the Rishon who said, so why didn't the rabbis make halakha? I think the tension lives and still exists by way of the Gemara presenting it like this.
I don't think that the Beit Avidan was just a think tank just for religious discussion about the contents. I think at that time, the Tkufat of the Minim, it was a stormy political time in Israel at the same time, and it was every section that had some religious view had some political power behind it, because it was the Roman were at that time in Israel, and we moved out, they kicked them out from Jerusalem, and there was a big fight between Jews among Jews and the Minim, which are other sections that everyone wanted to take title about power at the time. religious power.
Right.
So I think it was a political power, more not just religious discussion or argument.
Yeah. So let me read you what the language section of Steinsaltz says regarding this term. Avidan uve nitzrofi. These two names are difficult. Some commentaries say that the confusion in the Gemara is intentional. The house of Abidan may derive from the Iranian compound Bagdan, meaning container of the god, i.e., it's a temple, where they were arguing not about meaning, but about what, at that time? Zoroastrianism. Right? The rabbis of ancient Babylonia are typically up against Zoroastrianism. What's fascinating in this whole world is if anybody's ever heard Rabbi Yaakov Ellman talk about this as definitive of the period, is that we often think of Jews in Roman Palestine, and we often think of Jewish people being up and against Christian ideas. But in fact, the rabbis of Babylonia are in particular dealing with Zoroastrianism and all of the typical culture of Zoroastrian, Sasanian Persia. And it's a very interesting kind of differentiation to make in one's thinking when it comes to understanding this period of the Talmud. And what do we know about it? We didn't know too much about it. And Rabbi Yaakov Ellman, who is a scholar of Sasanian Persia, and this language, and this religion, Zoroastrianism, and the typical rituals of Zoroastrianism, is able to explain to us what some of the developments are by way of the rabbis' thinking and their limits or not making limits, or their encounters with the culture, based on his understanding of these things. And he is a professor who's willing to even bring that into certain circles in Orthodoxy, where people just literally are red in the face listening to him talk. So his work is brilliant and understudied in this regard. That said, this makes a lot of sense, that they were encountering temples in Babylonian life, Sasanian Persian life. And that it wasn't only about the kind of typical encounter with early Christians or Jewish Christians. Remember, the lines of law and accepting messianism are very fuzzy for a certain amount of centuries before it becomes hard and fast. Okay, so that's one possibility. The meaning of the house of Nitzrefi, or Mitzroifi, is more elusive. It has been suggested that the term means house of burning, from the Semitic root Nisraf, or Sraf, and refers to, again, a Zoroastrian fire temple. However, it now seems more likely that it originated from a Parthian word meaning Nazarene, an ancient name for Christians, which are a little closer to run to the whole notion of meaning, and refers to some sort of Christian church. So, interesting etymologically, interesting sociologically, encounters-wise, and I think they didn't limit it because there was great fluidity at the time of religious experience, ideas, messianism, Zoroastrianism in Babylonia, even in ancient Palestine, Palestinia, right? What the Romans named it. I think you have a little bit of that here, and thus no hard and fast rules. So, anyway, there's all kinds of encounters with all kinds of people, all kinds of houses of potential worship, intellectual pursuits, and now the next story in the Gemara for tonight. Interesting story. Going to come about Ima Shalom, who's the wife of Rabbi Eliezer, the sister of Rabban Gamliel, very, very top, you know, top tier royalty of the Jewish people here we're talking, right? And interesting what's going to happen by way of having to do a little bit of work to out a fraudulent judge in a non-Jewish court. Now the story gets to the fact that A, as explained before, the rabbis are working to ensure that there's a certain type of legal system and a certain type of religious system that really people subscribe to, and that texts within those legal systems are understood the way the rabbis want to understand them. And why is it connected to the discussion of this Mishnah, as every piece of Talmud and Gemara is ultimately somehow anchored back to the original Mishnah we studied? Because remember that we're going to get to this at the end of this section before the next Mishnah, that we don't allow reading from what? The Ketuvim, from the writing section of the Tanakh, because otherwise people would miss the afternoon lecture, or at least the lecture that the rabbi is going to give, the sage is going to give, in the synagogue, which is called the Beit Midrasha, on Shabbat. And that Beit Midrasha experience, that lecture from the stage, that's going to be the time that the rabbi expounds the law. It's going to be a time that you get connected to the law of Israel and how Torah is interpreted. It's going to be that time which you get connected to the Ur text, in other words, the manuscript now, the single text that we believe in. And it's going to be the time that you basically agree to be part of the community. Because if you're out reading the great story of Esther in Greek translation, you're not with us. And so that's in the background of all this. Then there are the philosophers and the people who are really convincing about their new ways of both doing religious cultural things and holding court. And they want you to come to their courts. And since some of those judges are saying, I'm going to base my rulings based on Torah law, or at least the new law that you Jews have even recognized to be the new law, because what's floating around is legal interpretations of verses that allow me to make applications when parties to cases come my way for adjudication, you could trust me, says these judges. So this is the theater in which all this is happening, and this story comes. Ima Shalom, the wife of Rabbi Eliezer. Devit hu de Rabbi Eliezer, atache de Rabban Gamliel Havai. Ima Shalom, the wife of Rabbi Eliezer, was the sister of Rabban Gamliel. Hava hahu philosopha v'shava vute. There was in their vicinity a certain philosopher. Okay? Now this, according to Rashi, philosoph is a sectarian. He was one of the meanim. Remember, we have in the Amida the saying that these people are trying to uproot Torah. Right? They're trying to overturn it, whether it's with messianic belief or it's with other kinds of interpretations. We're not exactly sure that it has to be only one category.
Different direction from the Sanhedrin.
A different direction than the Sanhedrin is a good way to put it. Okay, turn the page. We're on 116b1 now. We're on the other side of the dock. Always feels nice to turn the dock. Just never lose that feeling. Making big progress. Okay. The Hava Shakil Shema Delo Mekabel Shuchta. And he assumed the reputation that he would not accept bribes from litigants who came before him. Now, it says that he got that reputation because, like the Gemara is presenting it, that he is. Ba'ul la'achu cheve, Rabban Gamliel and Ima Shalom came to, it says in the translation, ridicule, but really the word is, I don't understand the translation exactly. It's why every translation is an interpretation unto itself. They came to basically expose his fraud, to disprove him as a judge. So Ima Shalom secretly brings him a golden lamp as a bribe, and went before him for litigation. Now, if you say, how could the Gemara present a case where somebody so high up is framing somebody, I don't have to remind you of good police work, right? On the one hand, you can't have entrapment. On the other hand, what can I do? I can set up some kind of sting. You know, somebody with a little bit more criminal legal experience could shed light, but in the basics of it all, there is a certain amount of engaging with criminality and criminals that I can indeed put myself into an undercover role. I can put myself into a potential buying situation in order to catch the person who's selling the drugs, right? So back then, the law works in somewhat the same way. If I want to expose somebody for fraud, I can, in kind of a semi-public way, expose the fraud. So if someone has a scale that's not right, and I'm not a bean seller, I don't sell lentils, I can tomorrow take a sack of lentils, set it up across, sell a cob of lentils or whatever the measurement is, and expose the fact that the bag's coming from this guy over here who says he's such an honest broker, don't look exactly the same. People, by looking and comparing, will see that he's a fraud, right? A little bit of that behind the scene as well. But we could ask the question, on the other hand, on a simple sense of the text, seems like an interesting way to actually make a point. How far does it have to go? Hold that question. See what you think of the story. So Ina Shalom wishes to ridicule him, and she brings him a golden lamp. By the way, golden lamp, why is it so impressive?
It's gold.
It's not made of clay. I mean, gold today still has some precious worth, but back then especially, to have a lamp that's not a seashell that I turn this way, or clay that I use like this, well, this is something. The case opens up. Amrale, she says to the judge, Ba'ina de niflagili benichse deve noshai. I desire a share in the property of my father, in my father's estate. Okay, what's the only problem with that? What she might be implying is, I have a brother. And we know that in the Torah, if there's a brother, the woman doesn't inherit. Amar Lahu, she says to them, he says to them, says the judge to them, Plogu, divide the inheritance. Amar Lehi, Rabbi Gamliel comes and says, what? Ketiv lan b'makom barav barata lo terut. It's written for us in our Torah, where there's a son, a daughter doesn't inherit. Amar Lehi, the judge says to Rabbi Gamliel, min yoma Digleitun me arachon itn natulait oraita de Moshe, the it yahivat sifra achariti. From the day your people were exiled from your land, the law of Moses has been uprooted. There's a different law now. And a different book was given. Sifra Achariti. Uchativ Bey, and what's written in that book is Bara Uvarata Kachada Yirtan, that a son and a daughter inherit equally. Now, the note here says that other scholars besides the Jewish scholars would dispute the sages, even in regard to the verse in Numbers cited in the previous note. They asserted that the words, and has no son, in the verse that they're actually referring to, in other words, the only time that you have a portion for a daughter is when there is no son,
But Moses agreed to give to the daughter of Slopacha.
Oh, that was one time when they made a lot of noise.
No, but it was, yeah, they made a lot of noise, but it became the law of the land.
They had to marry back in. So if you think about what happens to the daughters of Tzlochad that Ron's referring to in the Torah, who don't have a portion, and they go to Moses and they get a portion, and it seems so radically beautiful, if you're talking about the women's portion, they actually have to marry back into the tribe.
Yeah, but they still get their part of the
brothers.
Right. So anyway, let's keep that aside for a minute. This case is about a case where he's saying there's a different text and a different way of entirely ruling regarding inheritances.
That supersedes the law of Moses. This is pretty radical.
Right, pretty radical. And Lamachar, here's what happens the next day. Hadarayale ihu hamra luva. The next day, Rabban Gamliel brings him a Luvian donkey. Alluvian donkey. Alluvian donkey is a donkey. It's a donkey that works.
Better than a golden lamb.
Better than a... Right, so that's what the Gemara is going to say. Alluvian donkey is a donkey known to have very high capacity for carrying and stamina. A really good donkey. Amar lahu. And he says to them, reconvening the court, Shapli lasefe de sifa. The Chatav Bey, proceeds to the end of the book, wherein it's written, Ana lo l'mifchat, min oraita de Moshe atiti, v'lo l'asve al oraita de Moshe itaiti. I come not to detract from the law of Moses, nor to add to the law of Moses. Uchativ Bey, and in the law of Moses it's written, v'makom bara barata lo tiru, where there's a son, a daughter doesn't inherit. Wait a minute. Now you got the difference here? Amra lei, she says to him, Nahor narech kishraga, let your light shine forth like a lamp.
She's reminding
him. Wink, wink.
Let your light shine forth like a lamp. Come on, let your ruling be enlightened by the lamp light that you now have. Amar lei, Rabban Gamliel, and Rabban Gamliel says to him, Ata chamra uvatash lishraga, a donkey's come and kicked over the lamp. You know, like Chad Gadya. So here you have the story, you know, right? It's a great moment of exposing this judge who believes that another Sefer came to out do the Torah of Moshe, and then all of a sudden he can go back to the learning he needs with the Torah of Moshe, that is not to uproot it, and go back to the verse as it's quoted by the litigants and accept the bribe that the Torah, by the way, says not to accept, and he's exposed as a fraud.
What does this have to do with what we were just
But it has to do like this. The connection is this. So the connection in the broad sense here that I can make out is that at the heart of our Mishnah still is the question of who owns the text, who's written the original text, in what language it is, and how it's interpreted. Remember, the rabbis are arguing, and this is where we're going to get now to the next section of this Gemara. The rabbis are talking about their being the arbiters of midrashic, halachic formulation, legal interpretation of our text.
Of text.
So this is a distortion of the text. And thus what? From that judge's chambers, if you owned that text and it was inside your house and a fire was broken out on Shabbos,
you definitely wouldn't
save it.
And I don't think
you might
save
even
the
throw
judge.
It in.
You might even
save the judge either.
So I just think it's all about the fundamental questions of moving into the zone of having one text and one set of interpreters. And then whether we save them or not is, in a certain sense, the part of the Shabbat laws that we're really talking about here. And, incidentally, or by way of that Mishnah about those laws, we're going to tell you about the history of how fluid these texts were, of what people were doing to bastardize them, and how we had to protect, and that's why we're telling you, don't go home and read stories on Shabbat from Ketuvim. Come to the Beit Midrash, hear what it is we're teaching, how we interpret the law, what the verses are supposed to say. I just have to ask this question. Does anybody else smell toast?
Oh, it smells very good.
It smells like onions.
Somebody's cooking.
Okay, it's cooking there. I'm not going to be nervous anything's burning, right?
No.
Okay. I'm talking about fires on the Sabbath. I just want to be sure that we haven't lit anything.
I would just add the interesting example of the lamp to bribe the judge.
Yeah.
When you look at all the paintings of the Adoration of the Magi coming to Jesus for their gifts, all of them are carrying lamps. So lamps must have been very honored objects.
Aladdin.
And these were gold. I mean, most of the time they're presented as gold.
Containers for the spices that were in gold.
No, I think they're containers, and these are also.
Well, it's funny you say that,
look
because
like that
I
shape.
Find
it. Yeah, they're that shape. So I think it's a presentation of what's precious, what's acknowledged.
But this quote is very familiar. Issue on those things. Well, no, I come not to detract from the law, not to add.
Yes.
Was that there's a new law?
But he's not a new law.
Not, yeah, but I've come not to detract, not to, nor to add.
I mean, for sure, I've heard it. I can't say that it jumped out at me as being exactly... But you know what? It's an interesting question. Is that the actual Lashon of the New Testament?
Well, I haven't seen the original. I don't know if the Aramaic is the same verbatim. But no, it struck me when we read this.
You know, we should check that out. I have the... you know that we can do a search.
Yeah, sure.
Okay. Let me point out one thing that I just have to kind of again you get the nature of who we are as a people. Some people can't possibly believe that there were actual bribes given, and that the police work had to be done in such a righteous way. So the Maharshal, the Maharshal. Who comments a lot on Agarita, on the more tales of the Gemara, says Rav Eliezer v'im Shalom enam natnu shachad lefilosof. They didn't actually give the items to this philosopher judge. Ela heralo. Rather, they just showed him. Now again, you could see this as apologetics with a capital A, that they were so, in a certain sense, protective and embarrassed or couldn't believe that such improper behavior from such high-ranking Jewish teachers. Or you could go one direction towards criminal jurisprudence, try to understand how serious sometimes they were about the law, which the Maharshal really was, and ask the question, is his comment quippy and apologetic, or is the comment based on some legal reasoning, some real careful approach towards outing fraudulent practice? I'd like to think sometimes when I read such quippiness and people are fast to say things, are apologetics for some of the actions of the sages, I'd like to think that some people have, high ethical standards for themselves. When I read that quip at first in the Steinsaltz, I have to say, I thought it was kind of funny. And then I got to thinking, I mean, I know how careful sometimes people can be in trying to keep within the bounds of the law. At least I want to think, again, that everyone's not so crooked as to apply this stuff. You know, when it comes to the kind of sting operations, the kind of undercover police work, you know, the serious nature, the serious study of police work in this vein, right? There's a lot of people who started to investigate. When did serious detective work really start to come about? You know, Les Bramble was a professor at Rockland Community College. They have quite an interesting set of justice courses there. They're quite a good, in terms of community colleges in New York State, quite a great honors program. There's quite a great Hillel there. I mean, it's an interesting place.
I'm confused. Why would it be an issue for him whether or not there were judges who were accepting bribes? These aren't Jewish judges.
No, but what I'm saying is that he's saying that they couldn't possibly have given a bribe because it says in Torah, in other words, you know, that they could just show him. So if you interpret it on that level.
No, I was thinking of the recipient. You're talking about the...
So I'm actually talking about this.
He's taking away from the story. It's funny that the story, that he could teach with the story, versus, let me give you a hypothetical. Hypothetically, some person goes to a judge and offers a lamp. Like, he could have done that too. But they presented it as a real story.
Right. I mean, he seems to be going against the shot. He seems to be protected. He seems to be saying, how could that be?
He's taking away from the whole thing, though, really. when it's a story, it's about this righteous family and involved in this thing. It's a lot better than hypothetical.
Right, and parsing it in such a way.
I still don't. Because they're trying to expose it. I mean, it doesn't reflect badly on them for doing it. The whole point was they were trying to expose the crooked judge. So, how does it reflect badly on you?
Well, it's the age-old question, do the ends justify the means? And on the one hand, you can consistently ask that and have lots of debates and never come to conclusions. But the Marsha is involved in that question in a certain sense.
It also implies that there's no authority to go to that's organized to do this sort of investigation.
Right.
They have to take it into their own hands. It means that there's no civil structure to go and make lodge a complaint or express concern.
Well, also it could be because they were the Jews in a non-Jewish environment and therefore had no recourse to anyone else. We're not privy if there was recourse to the people who were members of their own society.
Right.
And that would make more sense.
Yeah.
The outsider is treated differently than...
Yeah, but then the judge wouldn't be judging based on Torah Moshe.
Well, that's it. That's why I just asked Jay. That was confusing to me.
Right. So what was... So obviously there is a population of Jews here who, you know, he's trying to uproot it with vocabulary that's somewhat familiar to them and say,
right,
I have this different text, and the notion of textuality comes into focus here, what really guides our principles. And so, again, not to overdo it, but people make commentaries based on certain kind of motivations. And I was just going to fill in a little bit of what this professor once talked about, and that is that detective work with internal rules in regards to prosecutorial pursuits. In his estimation, were somewhat British in their design. Except that in the jurisprudence of Roman authorities and the jurisprudence of Jewish authorities before that, when you have Shomrim and Shotrim, you have magistrates, you have local courts, you have adjudication. The question really is, do we have any indication of any kind of procedural outline for police? We talked about this, remember, last year when we learned Sanhedrin. And that is that the two people who were witnesses to the road death, to the one chasing after somebody else to commit a murder, needed to themselves act. Same way here that you saw Ima Shalom and Rabbi Eliezer go through this action, and perhaps they themselves are the authority and the agency, that does this, or perhaps they just have to take it into their own hands. So that was kind of where I wanted to wonder aloud, what really is the history of such agency of police being involved with those who wish to, you know, ultimately prosecute the fraud? There's more to look at in terms of the history. Interesting, though, that that's the story. They exposed him. They gave him the stuff. Nothing worked. They exposed him. They don't have to worry about this guy now holding the authority or the authoritative text.
Last week, we talked about containers and putting texts or scrolls inside containers and them having some sort of value or truth. And here we have these containers or these things like these lamps being given to a judge for corrupt purposes. They don't contain any truth. They're just empty vessels of gold.
That is an empty vessel of gold. That's right. Has oil.
Trying to connect it to
slippery.
Trying to connect it to last week.
Yeah. Slippery stuff. That's a good Maharsha kind of comment too. When he doesn't, take apart the parts of the story, he might note. That's right, Ellen. You were going
to
show us. So Ellen's following up on last week's class as well.
So our background is Iraqi Jews, and they still very much believe in amulets. And I have I took my husband's amulet that was on his crib as a baby. I made it to a necklace, but anyway, this is the basic framework.
She wore it on Shabbat.
Yeah, it's really a nice piece. And then when my daughters are born, his aunt.
Can I hold it and show
sure.
it from the other side?
Is there something in it?
No, that's
there right. There was. They put cork in it. I don't understand the cork. So when my daughters were born, Saint Anne, from a mudgun that had been made for the girls, they're somewhat fragile. With garlic, cork is in the middle of the amulet, and blue stones to ward off the evil eye. Well, the whole thing is...
Any writing on it?
No.
No.
No, and I don't know what the other
thing is. I have to tell you that there is a lot of contemporary jewelry, very high-style jewelry makers, that are just
having
their eyes doing whatever
it's
like. Yeah, but I mean, like not in Israel, like in America, these non-Jewish, but whatever, designers are doing eyes and all kinds of
things. Yeah, that's right.
Well, amulets around the whole religious world, various religions are very important within that. What we had a lot of times were the differences between amulets that are more like charms and that had these superstitious contents, like the eye that wards off the evil eye, or garlic that wards off certain spirits. Yeah. So people debate about whether or not those symbolic stones and pieces are Talmudic or even earlier. People actually see that in the Talmud, that certain foods ward off and things like this. The writing piece, I bet you in that gold one, that there might have been a scroll.
There might have been. Or cork. I say the answer told me they put cork. I'm not sure why.
They put cork.
Yeah.
I'm not sure.
Yeah,
it's here.
So this is like a shell.
Yeah.
Tower shell.
Interesting. Interesting.
When I delivered, right away, my cousin came with an evil eye. I'm not kidding you. It had to be this big. And maybe now. I couldn't take it off for the longest time.
How'd it work out?
You warded off the evil eye, huh?
Yes, I had to wear it.
It works.
My mother-in-law did something underneath the bassinet thing that was a red bezel.
No.
These are from the girls.
Yeah, that
what
one
else did you put in that thing?
Is for current.
So this is from her daughter.
For 20 now? 18.
They
swept everything from her mom down to her.
I just want to make one comment. That is, I actually think that
a rock. There's something about even just showing him the thing that shows that he's instinctual. This judge, all he has to do is see it, and that it's like flashing him, you know, like a signal. That he, it's not like the first time. He doesn't even have to have the actual, transfer of the thing. It's just a suggestion that he's
that's what the Maharsha is saying.
So that by saying that they just kind of, show him.
Right.
It means that he's just so used to doing it. He does it when he it's
All right, let's catch into a little bit more Gemara before we end today. So, we get back to the last segment of the Mishnah now to pull it all together. Umipneima ein korin, and why don't we read from them? In other words, why don't we read from Ketuvim, the writings part of the Tanakh, on Shabbat? That was to prevent people from becoming too engrossed in them and fail to attend what? The rabbi's lecture. Because the rabbi's lecture is, of course, the most important thing. You have to come to the lecture. You have to hear the drush. You have to hear the elongated sermonics and all of the legal reasoning. We'll be instituting such a practice. That or is a... No. Amar Rav. That's good. Eric says he's going to put up a palm tree if I have too long a lecture after Shabbat service. He's going to plant the palm tree.
No, we're all going to get little stickers on our hands. Palm tree!
Okay, Amar Rav. Rav says the following. Lo shanu ela b'zaman beta midrash. They said don't read ketuvim, in other words, the writings, right? Psalms, wisdom book called Proverbs, the five Megillas, or the one Megillah Esther, Eicha, Lamentations, all those. Don't read Divrei HaYamim, Chronicles. Don't read Daniel. Don't read Book of Daniel. Don't read those on Shabbat. You have to come to the Beit Midrash. No, but they only said that during the time of the Beit Midrash. In other words, there was a certain time that the rabbis gave this lecture, so you shouldn't read it then. Aval shelo b'zaman Beit Midrash, but if it's not the time of the Beit Midrash, when the rabbi's giving the lecture, Karin, you should read it. Shmuel Amar, but Shmuel says, afilu shelo b'zaman Beit Midrash, ein Karin. Even when they're not giving the lecture in the shul, you shouldn't read it. Gemara asks, Aini? Is that really so? V'ha Nehardea Atre de Shmuel Hava. Why, Nehardea was the place of Shmuel, and he was the dean there at that big house of learning. Uvin Nehardea Paske Sidra B'chetuvim B'minchot de Shabta. And in Nehardea, they would recite a chapter from Ketuvim during the Sabbath Mincha service. So what does that say? Shmuel, who you just told me, said, even not during the time of the Beit HaMidrash, you shouldn't read from Ketuvim. Oh, but during Mincha, I heard that he actually did say part of Ketuvim during the service. Now, what is that actual practice? There are those who would say that perhaps the Gaonim kept the tradition alive of what Shmuel would do during Mincha service of Shmuel in Nehardea. And if you've been to Mincha on Shabbat before, and you've davened, sometimes after Hagba Galila, when the Torah is being scrolled, if there's no El Maleh, because the typical time for an El Maleh Rachamim for those whose Yartzeit are coming is Mincha and not during morning services. That's side kind of past practice of two verses today. At that time after Hagba Galila, you hear people say, Mizmor Shele Yom HaShabbat Tov Lehodot L'Adonai L'Zamer L'Shimcha Elyon. They would recite the psalm that we call the psalm for Shabbat. Mizmor Shir Leyom HaShabbat. The psalm for Shabbat. Tzadikat Amar, that one that has Tzadikat Amar. Like a palm tree, the righteous shall flourish. The Gemara accepts this objection and revises its account of the dispute. Eila itmar hachi itmar, rather if the dispute was stated at all, this is how it was stated. Amar Rav. Rav said, Lo shanu ela b'makom beta midrash. They didn't teach this except in the makom, in the place of the beta midrash, where the rabbi actually sits and delivers the lecture. In other words, don't carry other books into where the rabbi's talking. That happens to this day, by the way. Some people feel like in the synagogue proper, there's a time to bring either books of the Tanakh. What this position is, Rob's position, and it's, is that no other books should be brought in. And there are those whose position is completely, especially, not books from the outside world. Ah, Baal Shalom, Bimakom Beit HaMidrash Korin. But if you're not actually in the lecture hall where anything's happening, then Bakashah, read what you want. Ushmuel Amar, but Shmuel said, Bein Bimakom Beit HaMidrash, Bein Shalom Bimakom Beit HaMidrash, whether you're in the place of the Beit HaMidrash, the lecture of the rabbis, or you're not in the place of the lecture, Bizman Beit HaMidrash Ein Korin. At the time of the lecture of the rabbis, you don't read it. So you don't read it if you're sitting there during the lecture, and you don't read at 10 a.m. if 10 a.m. is the time the lecture is going on, you don't read anything else. Shalom Bizman Beit HaMidrash, and if it's not the time of the Beit HaMidrash, Korin, you read, you can read these sections. Gemara says that the custom of Nardeya in this matter is now consistent with the view of Shmuel. And Shmuel goes according to his own line of reasoning, if we say it was like that. For in the Hardeya, they would actually recite a chapter of Ketuvah during the Sabbath Mincha service. So, note here. Gemara doesn't mean to imply that Rav would forbid this practice. Rather, the Gemara means that according to the present explanation, the custom in the Hardeya no longer contradicts Shmuel. So he's just working it out for his friend there. Now, whether or not, by the way, it was actually the song for Shabbat, I can't be 100% sure. And I haven't found that in the customary explanations of the Gemara, but I'm surmising that, and I have an email out to Rabbi David Glinken of the Schechter Institute in Jerusalem to see if perhaps they're really discussing this practice of saying a psalm in liturgy, of saying the psalm for Shabbat in liturgy. Okay, now, to end right before the next Mishnah, as we wanted to, we're going to do this. Rav Ashi Amar La'olam Kida Amar Me'ikara. Rav Ashi says, actually, it is as we said originally, that Shmuel maintains that the prohibition is enforced the entire day. Oh, we just worked out so nicely that it was according to Shmuel, and we figured out his whole system, and he really meant the place and the time. And no, Rav Ashi says, wait a minute, Shmuel said you can't read it all day. Ushmuel Rabbi Nechemia. And Shmuel was going according to Rabbi Nechemia. And he said, what? He disputes the Tana of our Mishnah as to the reason for the prohibition against reading Ketuvim. The Tanya, as it says in a Braita being a teaching from the Tanaim in the time of the Mishnah, didn't make it into the Mishnah. Even though they said that the holy writings may not be read on the Shabbat, meaning of the Ketuvim, of the writing section of the Tanakh. Aval shonin behem, v'dorshin behem. However, we may study the oral Torah pertaining to them. And we may expound them in lectures. In other words, if I'm telling you a lecture, and I need a verse from Daniel, I need a verse from Esther, I need a verse from Shir HaShirim, Song of Songs, which is used a lot in rabbinic parlance, legal parlance. If I need a verse from the Psalms, I can bring that verse. It's not as though it's like I'm reading the text. That's Rabbi Nechemia here, explaining I can use this section. Nitzach lefasuk mevi v'roevo. Further, if one needs to look up a verse for a reference, like I can't remember the last three words, but I know there's a verse over there, he can bring a scroll and look into it. So then I can actually take out the scroll with it and go and find it. Indicating what? Tanaitic Braita? Not everyone has them entirely memorized. Amar Rabbi Nechemia. Rabbi Nechemia said, "Mitnei ma amru kitvei hakodesh ein korin behen." Why did they say that the holy writings may not be read on the Sabbath? So what is the reason? Shouldn't read from this. Kadeshi yomru, so that people should say, "Bechitvei hakodesh ein korin." If we may not read the holy writings on the Sabbath, v'chol shekein b'shitrei hedyotot, how much more so ordinary documents? In other words, Rabbi Nechemia wants us to know particularly if the Mishnah is saying don't read from them. Not to say that if I need it in a lecture, I can't drush it. I can't make a legal ruling from one verse or another. I could even reference it quickly and try to find it so I can bring it into my rabbinic discourse. But I don't allow people to go back and simply sit with their writings and scroll through them for enjoyment, or simply gather together in their own little home to, what? Legally interpret the verses. Now I'm not just talking about the stories of Esther. I'm not just talking about the story of Daniel. I'm talking about the legal rulings that come from looking at a verse and understanding that it has some implication as to the rituals of Shabbat that I am creating, has some implication about the adjudication between people regarding public space, private space, property, even matters of criminality. I have to be careful not to let them read that, drush it themselves in private. I have to not let them read letters that come to each other for business purposes, because I want to also respect what the prophets say, that I don't do business on Shabbat. And I also have to be careful not to let them read outside texts, of course. So if I can't already read these, I for sure can't read those. That's what ultimately we hear Rav Ashi saying, Shmuel said in Ardea, according to the ancient tradition of Rabbi Nehemiah.
So if there is a fire in my house on Shabbat, I cannot say the ketubah for my wife?
Interestingly, the answer is you don't save contracts.
That's the best way. It's better, it's cheaper to put fire.
So can you kind of guess that a ketubah? I mean, if that burns, what will happen?
Yeah. It's an interesting question. You know what? Let me look into the sugya. I believe. Actually, I want to go back a little bit on what I quickly said. Wait, I want to go back on what I quickly said. I believe that a woman in maybe in Masechet Ketubot, maybe in Hilchot Ketubot. A woman can take her ketubah.
She can go back in the fire.
And even the case in which it exists, if it has other items in it, which we're going to get into in the next part of the Gemara, meaning if there's money or there's jewelry or there's something else. But you know what? It's a great question, and we'll leave it as needs to be investigated. Vis-a-vis sacred documents and important documents that we have in life.
So I suppose this means iPhones on Shabbos are out.
Unless the screen has the Torah written, you know, from the app. And you know, maybe it's the case that has the money that has the Torah, which again we'll get into next week. You have to come back.
So when was the first money? It's obvious they don't have Shim Shalom, because everybody's doing their own thing on Shabbat, right?
Mm-hmm.
When was the first codification?
Thank you.